It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferret is out today. Coming up on Central Time, we'll chat with Milwaukee musician Peter Mulvey, who's about to embark on a marathon 12-hour concert. We'll get a preview. But first, the governor officially said no today to a proposed casino and Hard Rock Cafe in Kenosha. The Menominee Indian Tribe hoped to open the casino off-reservation at the former Dairyland Greyhound Park Dog track located 30 miles away from a Potawatomi Tribe-run casino. Citing concerns about a state mandate that would require the government to reimburse the Potawatomi for any financial losses incurred by the new nearby casino, Governor Walker said no to the deal altogether. Kenosha Mayor Keith Bosman joins us now with his reaction to that decision. Mayor Bosman, welcome to Central Time.
Well, hello, Veronica, and thanks for the invitation to be here.
Well, first of all, what was your reaction when you heard the governor's decision today?
Well, I was extremely disappointed. Certainly, this is a project that we have been working on along with our partners, the Menominee, for many years. And I thought that perhaps the governor and the administration was moving towards a better outcome. And there was an article in the paper this morning here with Paul Ryan urging the governor to sign the compact. And that's why I was kind of caught by surprise this morning.
Well, this old Greyhound track can be used for other development to bring in other income. Why was it important to you that the Menominee be given the right to develop it?
Well, it's such a huge development, number one, with so many jobs tied to it. $800 million in construction over a period of years, many hundreds, if not thousands, of jobs that would be tied to the casino once it opens and starts building out. You know, a 400-room hotel, a concert venue, a sports venue, shops. So it's a lot more than just a casino. And certainly would be a welcome addition to southeastern Wisconsin. I think a boon to the state of Wisconsin, especially with the Hard Rock brand attached to it. That, you know, it's a worldwide iconic brand that I thought Wisconsin would welcome, but evidently not.
The governor's decision hinged on concerns about a tax burden to the citizens of Wisconsin. The governor said that it was possible Wisconsin would have had to pay the Potawatomi for losses incurred and also money for breaking an exclusivity contract, and he was worried that that would trickle down to Wisconsin taxpayers. What about those concerns? Are they justified?
I didn't have those concerns. The Menominees have said over and over again that they would make up any losses that were proven to be incurred by the Potawatomi. I think if you've got $800 million in construction, the jobs that go with the construction, the income tax that the state would get from thousands of people working at the casino, the tourism money that would be brought to Wisconsin, I think the upside was certainly much, much more than a potential downside.
Some opponents to the casino had said that Wisconsin didn't need another casino. What do you say to that?
Well, gambling is everywhere. Gambling is throughout Wisconsin as we speak. And I can tell you, the Illinois state line is about 10 miles from where I sit. And the leadership in Illinois has just changed. Governor Quinn, who is not the governor anymore, was anti-gambling. Governor Rauner, who just has taken his place, I think, is at the other end of that spectrum. I would expect Illinois would begin production of a facility right across the state line, which would leave Wisconsin with all of the problems and none of the revenue.
Have you talked with any of your partners on the Menominee Tribe to hear how they've been reacting to this news today?
Well, I have not, but these are our friends. These are people that we work with very closely. For many years, they are wonderful people. Kenosha will recover. I mean, this is the property that we have. This 180 acres is contiguous to I-94. It's very hot for economic development. We've had several major victories over the last few years here. But the Menominees will return to Kashina, to the reservation. They will continue to be the most impoverished tribe in the state of Wisconsin. This does nothing to help them. I would hope that perhaps we can partner with them in the future. But I feel I'm just heartbroken for them.
Returning to the issue of jobs, which was one of the things you were most excited about with this big development, reportedly Amazon has opened a shipping plant in Kenosha, which has curbed unemployment in the Kenosha area. Do you think that Kenosha still has the potential to attract big major companies to the area?
Well, I think we do. We certainly have enough land available for development. The Amazon development was on about 150, 160-acre plot. The proposed casino is something like 180 acres, so it doesn't take a lot to eat up a lot of land when these big developments come anywhere. We've got Uline that will build a million-square-foot warehouse and call center immediately across the highway from Amazon. So I think, you know, being our location here in southeastern Wisconsin, you know, we'll recover from this. But I think it would have fit in greatly with our tourism. We have a lot of tourism available here. It's we're located immediately between Chicago and Milwaukee in this very vibrant corridor here. It's easier to get to Kenosha from O'Hare than it is to get to downtown Chicago. So we saw this as a Midwest destination for tourism, for business travelers, and it's just not going to happen.
And do you have your eyes on anything else for this dog park area now that the casino is off the table?
Well, it's not the property isn't controlled by the city of Kenosha. It's still owned by the Alabama folks who were upgrading the Dairyland Greyhound Park. But our master plan would call for business park industrial development on the site. Certainly it's contiguous to I-94. It's just south of the Amazon development, just south of the Kenosha Airport. So it's a very valuable piece of property that I think would develop in the short term. And we see it as some kind of industrial development with jobs, but certainly not the jobs that a casino and not the money that a casino would bring to the area.
Now, just a couple of minutes ago, you said that you hoped that you could still somehow partner with the Menominee tribe down the road. Anything in mind in particular?
No, there's nothing on the table at this point. But I feel very disappointed for the Menominee. They are great people. We would jump at the opportunity to partner with the Menominee in the future. We've got a great relationship, and the same with Hard Rock and the Seminoles. You know, if anything was put on the table, we would certainly listen and actually reach out to those folks because they're good people, and I am very, very disappointed that they're going to walk away empty-handed on this. As I say, we will recover. Kenosha will recover. We'll move forward, but all of the work that the Menominee tribe has put in over the last 10 years certainly will not be rewarded.
Mayor Bosman, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you, dear. It's a pleasure.
That was Keith Bosman, mayor of the city of Kenosha, reacting to Governor Walker's official no to their proposed Menominee Casino in Kenosha.
With everything that we do and do not know.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. We're hearing a song from Milwaukee musician Peter Mulvey. It's off his latest record, Silver Ladder. Mulvey's about to embark on what could be a musical first. Tomorrow he'll be playing a 12-hour online concert live from the Cafe Carp in Fort Atkinson. That means 12 sets of music with no repeats. He's calling it the one-day world tour, and he joins us now from our Milwaukee studios to tell us more about it and play us a song or two. Peter, thanks a lot for coming in and talking today.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me, Veronica.
So as we said, you're planning to be playing nearly 12 hours of music tomorrow.
Yes, actually, it's happening on Sunday. It's not tomorrow. It's Sunday that the concert's happening. But
right,
yes,
well, that's important to note. So this is happening on Sunday. You've got a day to rest up and prepare. Where
yes,
did you
I
get
do.
This idea to perform for 12 hours?
Well, Probably way back 20-some years ago in the late 20th century, I was living in Boston, and I was a subway musician, and I would play all day. So then from there, I went on to start touring, and I've toured pretty heavily for the last 22 years all over the planet. And recently, these concert window concerts started popping up. I've done one before, and it's streaming online. You're basically singing into a webcam, and people can tune in online. And so I did one just from my office in my house, and it was strange but beautiful. I just played for about 45 minutes, and about 150 people tuned in from all over the places that I tour. So there were people from, Montana. There were people from the East Coast, people from Alaska, people from New York City. And there were people from Ecuador and Argentina, places that I have never been, but they had heard of my music maybe on the internet or had maybe seen one concert that I'd played somewhere in America. And they tuned in, so that's where I got the idea to do this as a sort of more globally focused event.
Well, at this point in your career, you're probably used to playing in front of people that you can see. What is it like to play for people who are watching online?
It's unsettling. But it's also semi-delightful. There's a little chat window where people, post their comments. And it just goes about a mile a minute when you have a few hundred people all logged in at once. So that sort of visual noise, I guess, is what I take as a cue that people are enjoying it. I sort of read that as applause. And then I try to just telepathically remind myself, right? You must do this all day, mustn't you, right? That you remind yourself that there are people at the other end of this microphone.
I guess I do. I mean, in radio, though, that the norm is not being in front of people. With you, you're used to being. Musicians live for the applause, right?
We do. I live for live performance. That's what I've made my living at, and that's what I love the most, which is why this is only the second online concert that I've ever done, because as fascinating as it was, I didn't want to just make a regular habit of singing into a laptop. I wanted to find something new to do with it.
Well, 12 hours again. What do you have planned to fill all that time?
Well, I've probably written a couple hundred songs, of which there are 90 that I would feel pretty good playing, 80 or 90. But also, over the years, I'm sure I know hundreds and hundreds of songs. I've learned many songs. It's one of the things you have to do to get good at songwriting. It's sort of the equivalent of those painters that go into museums and paint a painting. They look at the painting and paint it. You have to figure out what the people that really knew what they were doing were doing. And so I don't really have a shortage of songs. I could play all day, but I will say that there's going to be a whiteboard involved and sort of rough set lists that are going to keep shifting. Because one of the things we're going to do is every hour we're going to take a request from the audience, which means that something might get yanked out of a future set and put into the current set because the audience has decided that that's what they want to hear.
Well, I bet people are dying to hear more of your music, so let's do a little bit of that. What do you got for us?
This is another tune from Silver Ladder. This is called You Don't Have to Tell Me.
In the middle of the humdrum, there is a sound like a riddle. Waiting and waiting and waiting for your soul to solve it. And in the medicine cabinet, they got a pill to take the edge off. It's just waiting and waiting and waiting for your tongue to dissolve it. But you don't have to tell me. You don't have to tell me. You don't have to tell me. I already know. In the middle of a lifetime, the road gets a little squirrely. You might lose your sense of humor for a year or two. And in the middle of the ocean, there's a dolphin with a head cold. You probably think about him just as often as he thinks of you. But you don't have to tell me. You don't have to tell me. You don't have to tell me. already know. In the middle of emotion, you can wonder if you mean it, or you can just put a hand out, you could lay it on me. I could second that emotion, we can make the moment stand out, we could lock it all down, and we could set it all free. But you don't have to tell me, you don't have to tell me, you don't have to tell me. I already know. You don't have to tell me. You don't have to tell me. You don't have to tell me. I already know. You don't have to tell me. I already know.
Oh, Peter, that was fantastic. Thank you so much for sharing that with us. Now I'm thinking about all kinds of things, like dolphins with head colds.
Oh, thank
you.
So
much in your lyrics there.
Thanks a lot.
I got to hear more about your story. How did you go from being a busker in Boston to a musician in Milwaukee who's about to do a 12-hour concert?
Wow, a long story. I mean, so I grew up in Milwaukee, and then when I was 22, I moved out to Boston, and I just started playing in the subway because... frankly, because it really beat temping. I was working for a temp agency doing like data entry 22-year-old jobs. And then one day I went down in the subway and I made like $75 or $100 selling records and playing songs. And so then I was off and I played forever. And I booked myself every gig that I could find up and down the East Coast. Got associated with a small label in Massachusetts called Signature Sounds. Met my mentor, who is a guy named Chris Smither. He is perhaps most well known for having written Bonnie Raitt's tune, Love Me Like a Man. And he took me all around the world. I opened shows for him in England and Ireland and the Netherlands and Alaska and California. And then by that time, this would have been around the turn of the millennia. I was up on my own 2 feet and I had a regular touring schedule. And that's what I've done to make a living all this time. And so the 12-hour concert is a chance sort of to reassess. I mean, I'll be playing songs that I've written from all across my life, from when I was a kid all the way to now. But it's also a chance to get involved. I mean, you reach a certain point where you want to do more than just play music for people. And in this case, what I wanted to do was get involved. I found 12 nonprofits. So each hour I'll be shouting out to a different nonprofit, and I'll be donating half of the tips that come in online to the various nonprofits. And they've been spreading the word about it. It just feels really good to have the music do something more than just entertain.
So this is for a good cause. And you'll be playing at the Cafe Carp, which is sort of a home base for you. You call
this
a great Midwestern venue. What do you love about it?
Oh, the Cafe Carp in Fort Atkinson, Wisconsin, it's a rare thing. Most of the wonderful music venues in Ireland, to give you an example, are quite a bit like the Cafe Carp. That is to say that there are two rooms to the establishment, and one room is a nice little pub, restaurant, bar. And then there is a second room that is exclusively dedicated to live music. And so that's what they have at the Cafe Carp. They have the front room, which is a wonderful little bar and cafe right on the Rock River in Fort Atkinson. But the back room, the only thing that happens there is music. They have a little stage tucked in the corner. You can cram about 60 people into it. And I've been playing there since I was a kid. I mean, that was one of my first real deal gigs, was opening. I was opening for Pat Donahue, the guitar player from Prairie Home Companion. I opened a show for him 20-some years ago. And so I've been playing the Carp forever. And that's my spiritual, ground zero. Every year now I close up with a multi-night stand there with various guests. This past year I think we did 11 nights in December at the Cafe Carp.
Oh, that's a lot of nights.
Oh, it's fun.
I want to ask you, if people want to tune in and watch this, what's the website to go to?
The easiest thing would be to just go to my webpage, petermulvey.com, and from right on the front page, there'll be a link to the concert window site. Or you can quite simply Google Peter Mulvey Concert Window, and the first thing that'll come up will be the little viewer, and you will see me. I should also say, at 3 p.m., anywhere in the Western Hemisphere, I will be playing a set. That's kind of how this works.
That's very cool. Well, Peter, you've got some more music for us. What are you going to take us out with?
I'll take you out. This is a tune called What Else Was It? Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for joining us. We're talking with Peter Mulvey, 12-hour one-day world tour coming up on Sunday. Let's take a listen.
Took a shovel to the basement, and you blistered up your hands. You danced all night at the wedding. You stayed up drinking with the band. You made love until the daylight, creeping across the floor. Tell me, what else was it you were looking for? The book of all your precious sorrows.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferret is back on Monday. January 23rd is National Pie Day, as determined by the American Pie Council. They recommend you celebrate by slowing down and sharing some heartfelt gratitude with loved ones over a slice of pie. But we thought we'd celebrate now by talking about pie on this Food Friday. And we're taking your calls. What's your favorite kind of pie? What kind of pies are you known for? Do you have a specialty that everyone asks you for whenever there's a gathering or a get-together? And what tips, what advice do you have for how to make a great crust and your favorite fillings? Call in. We'll talk about everything to do with pie this half hour at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. Kate Lebo is back with us to talk about how to make the best pie. She's the author of Pie School, Lessons in Fruit, Flour, and Butter. Kate, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, Veronica. Thanks for having me again.
Well, I hear that you're not officially part of this American Pie Council, but why is January 23rd National Pie Day? We've already gotten some comments on Facebook that Pie Day should be, March 14th, 3.14.
Right.
So
well,
why today?
It is. We have two Pie Days. March 14th is Pie, P-I, Day is in the infinite number, and that one's actually recognized by the U.S. Congress. National Pie Day is run by the American Pie Council, and according to the Internet, which we always believe, was founded on the birthday of one very, very special pie fan who had apparently the power to make a national holiday that we all follow.
Seems like there's not a lot of fruit. I mean, in Wisconsin, there's not a lot of fruit in season, but what can we be making, you know, in terms of pies in January?
I'm sitting in Oregon right now, and often I'll be sitting in Washington on January 23rd, and there's not a whole lot available out here either. So what I end up doing is making pies with shelf-stable ingredients, nut pies, coconut pies, sour cream raisin pie is a Midwest favorite that got to be called funeral pie because you could make it any time of the year, just like you could croak any time of the year. So that might be a good one for January. But one of my favorite things to do is to use all the frozen fruit that I gather during the summer and froze myself. Kind of get the bags that have maybe one cup, two cups here and there, combine them and make what I call a mumbleberry pie.
Mumbleberry pie is up, by the way, on our Facebook page. Tell us about that one. How do you make mumbleberry pie?
Well, it's basically a mixed berry pie. What you need is just 5 to 6 cups of fruit, depending on how big your pie plate is. Any fruit will do. So you can have, I've actually used grated apple to help thicken the whole pie, but you can use berries, you can use cherries, you can use strawberries, apples, whatever you want, whatever you have on hand in the freezer. My recommendation is to take that frozen fruit, especially if you froze it yourself, which means it wasn't flash frozen, and thaw it, at least partially thaw it before you bake with it, because baking with frozen fruit, often you'll find that like the freezing process has created all this extra juice that is hard for the pie to thicken. So you thaw it, you drain that juice off. Save that juice for cocktails or something later, right? And then prepare the pie as you normally would, with maybe a cup of sugar, pinch of nutmeg, a squeeze of half a lemon, pinch of salt. Always want a pinch of salt in your fruit pies. Salt makes everything taste better. And usually about a third of a cup of flour and 2 tablespoons of butter to thicken it. That's the filling. That works for me every time.
It sounds pretty simple, and yet with pies, there is a bit of an intimidation factor sometimes, definitely with the pie crust. Why do you think people sometimes get kind of a mental block about making pie?
Well, we have that bromide, easy as pie, right, to make us feel bad when it doesn't go as easy as it says. But that comes from a time, we like to say our grandmother's time, but perhaps it was actually our great-grandmother's by now, where recipes were something that we learned by practice, that were handed down. And I'm not talking about a list of ingredients. I'm talking about how you move your hands in the kitchen, practices, you know, with the little snips of this and that that you keep and then incorporate into the next dish. That's easy as pie is referring to, just like cutting out all the instructions and just kind of knowing what to do, which we don't know anymore. So the thing about pie now that we tend to not know anymore is how important the weather is to pie, important the condition of the ingredients is, which is to say, as the humidity changes day to day, it really affects the condition of the flour that you're using, how much water it needs to become dough. And so that means that a very specific measuring technique isn't going to work for the very best pie dough. You have to pay attention to what's going on in the bowl and use just the right amount of water by seeing what's in front of you. That's my method anyway. There's a million that work well, but that's one that works for me.
Does it make it more rewarding to make that there's not an exact science to it? That is, sounds like it's a little bit of an art form.
I think so. And I think that this is something that's real particular to pie and pie makers that I know, is that we do tend to approach it as an art, that it's this intuitive thing that you mess up the first couple times as you get to know, just as you would mess up if you were like learning how to do pottery or something. You learn through your hands. Often, and through tasting and through looking at what you're doing. That's the art part of it. There is, of course, science going on. You know, there's chemistry. Baking is chemistry. But you're really paying attention to the materials of the pastry is what helps you make great pie.
Well, pies these days, they're all over the place. You can buy them pre-made in grocery stores, in bakeries. Sometimes you can just get one from a restaurant to go. Why is it worth the trouble to make our own pie?
Oh, God, we make the best pies at home. Sure, you can get one at the grocery store pre-made. You can get them at the bakery pre-made. But I have never seen even a bakery pie really beat a great homemade pie. That's another thing about pastry is it's best made in small batches by hand, which is something that most bakeries, just because of the kind of scale of economy, can't really do. They have to use sheeters often, things like that.
So you just made the case that we should be making our own pies, that they're better, and yet people do struggle. And you teach people how to make pie. This is part of what you do. What do people struggle with the most?
You know, I find that they struggle the most first with wondering where they're going to mess this up, because they have heard that pie making is difficult. And I think that they also struggle with trusting their instincts and touching the pie dough too much because of this nervousness that they bring to the bowl. Often we try to kind of console nervous situations by, you know, like imagine if you had a friend who was nervous, you'd pat her shoulder or something, say it's going to be okay. But you don't want to do that with pie. Pie, I like to say pie likes attention, not affection. The less that you touch it, the better it turns out.
Interesting. Yeah. So people need to, you know, check their nervousness. It's sort of an emotional training, too, it sounds like.
Yeah, some people say you got to get zen. I like to say you just have to be willing to mess up. Because often, once you're willing to mess up, you don't, is what I find.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the crust, because this, at least for me, is a sticking point, and I've tried numerous crusts, and it just generally ends up defeating me. What advice do you have about how to pull off a good crust?
Well, I would start with just a classic pie crust using all-purpose flour. Make sure your water that you're going to use to make the dough is ice cold. Put ice in it, put it in the freezer, let it get really, really cold while you prepare the rest of the ingredients. Also, make sure that your butter is chilled. You don't want it frozen, but you want it chilled. And it's best, I find, that higher quality butter, like Kerrygold or European-style butters, tend to be easier to work with, I think because they have a higher fat content. They also taste just a little bit better because of that higher fat content. Chilling those materials, using high-quality materials, that tends to help with the process.
So get everything ice cold and good quality butter. That sounds, yeah. doesn't sound
Use
too hard.
Use a light touch. Go by feel. If you've got a friend who's good at making pie, what a great excuse to get him or her in the kitchen and hang out for an afternoon baking pie. That's really the best way to learn. Like books, I mean, there's so many books, including mine, that are going to tell you they know how to do it. And of course they know how to do it. But pie is a folk art, which means that it's best passed from person to person, from hand to hand. The secret ingredient, I think, really is not the right, like the special orange juice that you sprinkle in, or the egg that your grandma used. I think it's actually your hands. It's how you touch the dough. That's the secret ingredient. And that is best learned when you're watching and when you're touching and when you're next to the person who's making it.
We've got a caller. Let's go to Jacob right now in Peshtigo. Jacob, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks. What is your favorite pie?
My favorite pie is strawberry pie.
What do you like about it?
What I like about strawberry pie is it's got a good sweetness, but it also has a little bit of a tart to it. I think it's really good.
And do you like, there's lots of embellishments, whipped cream, some people do cream cheese. Do you like any of that or just straight up strawberry?
I do enjoy cream cheese and the wheat. Also a lot of, I do like whipped cream on top, so that's pretty good too.
Yeah, sounds good. Jacob, thanks a lot for calling in. I'm with him. Strawberry's my favorite kind of pie, too. They're out of season right now. How do strawberries do as a frozen fruit when you're making pie?
You know, they're pretty good. My argument, I mean, far be it for me to argue with anyone's favorite pie. My argument is actually I don't think you should bake with strawberries because most of them are so much better when they are fresh. So I'll make, like, when I'm making a strawberry pie, I tend to make fresh strawberry pies rather than bake them, because when you've got that really juicy, sweet fruit, it tends to just bake down to mush, and the sugars aren't that interesting anymore. So that's why you see, like, strawberry and rhubarb, or strawberry and some other tart fruit.
And there are some good fresh fruit pie recipes out there, right, that you can kind of chop it, mix it with some cornstarch, and bake your crust.
Yeah, or a little bit. I've got a bunch of chiffon pie recipes in my cookbook, which I copped from one of my very favorite pie references, the Farm Journal's pie cookbook. And they're just a tome of fresh fruit pies from the mid-century that are also full of gelatin often, which is kind of fun. And retro, if you're interested in that.
Well, we're talking right now to pie expert Kate Lebo on National Pie Day, which is today. We're taking your calls. Do you have questions about making pie? Have you run into any roadblocks when you're making pie that you could use a little bit of help with? Kate is the person to help you. She actually teaches people how to make pie. And do you have a signature pie recipe? If you could only eat one pie for the rest of your life, what would it be? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. We're talking to author and pie expert Kate Lebo on this National Pie Day, celebrated every year on January 23rd. And we're taking your calls. We want to know what your favorite kind of pie is. Do you have questions about it, little tricks of the trade that you've learned over the years? And do you think people still make pie? Is it kind of retro now to make your own pie by hand, including the crust? What do you think? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. And we'll go to our first caller now. We've got Marlene joining us in Rio. Hi, Marlene.
Hi.
Do you have a favorite pie or a trick?
I sure do. Our favorite pie in my family is Derby pie.
And what is Derby pie?
I love it, and you guys don't know.
I don't.
Always disliked pecan pie because I thought it was too sweet. And I was visiting down in Kentucky, and they had a big reception, and they kept saying, oh, you've got to try the Derby pie. And I said, what is it? And they said, well, it's kind of like pecan pie, but much better. And I was like, yeah, no, I don't like pecan pie. And they kept after me, thankfully, and it's pecan pie with chocolate and just a hint of bourbon in it. It is to die for.
Agreed.
Well, that sounds okay. Have you heard of that one, Kate?
I have. That's a great one.
Derby pie. So obviously after the Kentucky Derby. Marlene, are you still there?
Yes, I am.
Do you know if people eat that around the Kentucky Derby, or is it a year-round kind of thing?
Well, they have it year-round down there, and we now, it's a staple during the holidays in our family.
Wow, that sounds fantastic. Thank you for sharing that with us. And, Kate, any other ways to switch it up with pecan pie that you know of?
You know, what's funny is that I have found that different regions in the United States are not as fond of pecan pie as the South, because pecans are from the South. And so I've ended up, my region, Washington, is so full of fruit that I've ended up mostly concentrating on fruit. All I know is the pecan pie recipe on the side of the Karo syrup box that my grandma made.
It's a good one.
I stand by that one.
Well, this one, the Derby Pie, had a little bit of bourbon. Anything else like that, adding a little bit of extra, shall we say, pizzazz to the pie?
Yeah, you know, I have been making one with, instead of that Karo, really natural sugars like honey and like maple syrup that add that extra delicious, you know, flavor that comes with those different sweeteners. You might try that instead.
Well, nice. Thank you, Marlene. And let's go next to Lisa. Lisa's joining us from Stevens Point. Lisa, hi.
Hi.
What is your favorite pie?
Well, I'm from Indiana, so my favorite pie is sugar cream pie.
Nice.
What is that? Can you describe that, Lisa? I don't know that one.
It's literally just sugar and cream.
Sugar and cream?
It is. Yeah, you put in a pint of cream and, you know, like a cup of sugar, pinch of salt, warm it up almost to boiling, and then pour it in a prepared crust and top it with a little bit of nutmeg and bake it. It's really just regional, and I think it may have been Amish originally, but I don't know.
Delicious. Do you top that?
Some people call it Hoosier
pie.
Or
whipped cream?
No, it's really, really just rich and creamy. It's just, you know, it's fluffy and creamy, but it literally is just sugar and cream.
And Lisa, have you had good success making that pie? Is that one of your greatest hits?
It is, because so few people know what it is. I've had some trouble because I always play around with a little bit, but sometimes if you over-bake it, it can flatten out and you don't get the lift that you need from it. And so it's just, you know, it's just too dense.
Well, it sounds fantastic.
So it's really hard to master.
All right. Well, that's a sugar cream pie, one I've never heard from. Lisa's from Indiana, and that's where she learned it. Thanks a lot for that call, Lisa. And Kate, does that bring to mind anything else, any really simple pies that still manage to be stunning?
You know, a great pie to make right now that is a shaker recipe is shaker lemon pie, also extremely simple. It uses Meyer lemons, which we're getting from the South right now. You slice those lemons super, super thin. You soak them in 2 cups of sugar overnight. You add a pinch of salt and 4 beaten eggs. Bake it in a double crust. And it's delicious. It's this really, really sweet, really tart, slightly, slightly bitter because you leave those peels on pie. And it's just to die for. You can even freeze it, actually. It's one of the only pies I eat frozen after I've baked it.
Okay, shaker pie. That's a good one to store away. Good for the Wisconsin winter, too. Well, thanks a lot, Lisa. And we're going to move on to Jane in Waukesha. Hi, Jane.
Hi. Yes, I love pie, but I also kind of feel guilty about the crust. And I only ever make a bottom crust. And I can, you know, even if it's whatever fruit or whatever, and that's probably why pumpkin's my favorite.
That's why you feel guilty, because you only make one crust?
No, I don't feel guilty.
You don't feel guilty.
Too much crust is too many calories.
I gotcha.
But
okay.
I make a no-roll pie crust. It's so easy. You just mix the ingredients right in the pie pan. It's like, you know, your flour and a little sugar and cold milk, I think. And then canola oil. So I kind of feel like it's a little better for me than straight lard or butter.
Okay, that's an interesting take. Thanks a lot, Jane, for that. Kate, what about canola oil in pie crust?
You know, that is an approach that I have seen from some of the bakers at the Iowa State Fair and in some other recipes that a good pat in the pan pie crust. It's real simple, delicious, maybe lower fat. I mean, whatever it takes to make the pie less guilt-free, let's do it.
Okay, well, thanks a lot for that call, Jane. Appreciate that. And we've been talking sweet pies generally. I know that's your forte, but do you have any savory pies that you especially like to do, Kate?
I do. You know, right now, one thing we can get really easy is just a lot of different root vegetables. So I will end up making a roasted vegetable pie. I'll pick maybe 1 cup each of 5 different vegetables, so it comes out to about 5 cups of vegetables. I'll roast them. I'll make a double batch, I'll make a batch of pie crust, and I will put those roasted vegetables into a double crust pie and then bake it until that crust is done. Serve it with a salad, serve it with a roast chicken. It's delicious, really good for winter. Sprinkle the top crust with salt instead of sugar. It's a little tip.
Oh, that sounds good. That's another one we can try. A quick email here from Ann in Madison who says, my mom used to make vinegar pie, which doesn't sound good, but is very yummy. A type of vanilla custard pie that has vinegar in the filling, which you can't really taste. It's made with a lot of ingredients you have on hand. Is that something you've heard of, vinegar pie?
Yes, that is a great pantry pie that you would do in the winter when you're just looking for whatever's.
What does the vinegar add to it?
It adds some acid, which is the same reason that you add a little bit of lemon to fruit pie, is it brightens up the flavors. It just makes everything taste a little better.
And here we are, National Pie Day, the 23rd. Of course, you'll have another crack at this coming up on March 14th. But, Kate, what are you doing to celebrate, and what is your favorite pie?
I'm driving up to Portland to teach pie school up there to the pie makers of Oregon. And I'm hopefully going to be making a cherry pie that I can share with my family right when I'm done.
Nice.
We got a bunch of sour cherries out here, and as long as they've been frozen, they are good to go for January 23rd.
Is that one of your favorites, just simple cherry?
That is one of my favorites. It's my father's favorite, so that's especially why it's my favorite to bring home.
And whipped cream or ice cream?
You know, if I get to boss people around, which I don't always, I will say put that ice cream and whipped cream on the side, whichever you want. I like it plain. I want to just taste that fruit.
Okay, it sounds good. Well, Kate, enjoy it, and thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be with you.
We've been speaking with Kate Lebo. She's the author of Pie School, Lessons in Fruit, Flour, and Butter. She was with us to talk about pie on this National Pie Day. Well, some big news out today for frequent flyers. The company behind the in-flight catalog, SkyMall, is filing for bankruptcy. And that means the catalog that brought you absurd products you never even knew existed, let alone wanted to own, could become a thing of the past. Central Time producer Chris Molina is here with us now to talk more about this. He's not really a frequent flyer, but he's a SkyMall enthusiast. Chris, SkyMall, is it going to go away? What's going on?
It sounds like it's quite possible that it's going away. So the company that owns SkyMall is filing for bankruptcy. You know, they're kind of citing the fact that, you know, when you're on the airplane, when you're taxiing, when you're landing, when you're taking off, you can use electronics now. So it used to be when you couldn't use the electronics, what else do you do? Well, you reach inside the seat in front of you and you grab the SkyMall and you start paging through it. And I don't know about you, Veronica, but I always thought that was one of the best parts of flying, was just cracking open the SkyMall. It was like a trip to Sharper Image times like 10 with the amount of crazy items in there.
And real quickly, Chris, what are your favorite products from SkyMall?
I was looking a lot online today. My favorite is the 3-in-1 bathroom accessory that is a bidet, a toilet paper roll holder, and an iPad cradle. So all in one.
SkyMall, we shall miss thee.
R.I.P.
All right. Well, thanks a lot, Chris.
Thank you.
I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferret is out. You're listening to Central Time.